First of all, I ought to say that I'm very grateful for the invitation to be in a part of England where they speak properly. This is my native county. I was born in County Durham. I'm sorry to say that the city of Sunderland moved, without moving physically, into the county of Tyne and Wear in 1974, which in my view was an abomination. County Durham was fine. While I've never been to Newton Aycliffe before, except on one occasion, I had my first job interview here. It looks very familiar because I spent the first 14 years of my working life in Peterlee, the second new town in the north of England. And everything around me at the moment looks surprisingly similar. So I'm glad to be with you. Now, I'm about to describe to you the biography of a church and the role in particular of a man called Thomas Tillam. You may never have heard of him. He's not an eminent man in the story of the Christian church. For the second session today, I'll be talking about two much more eminent people than him, Erasmus and Luther. But nevertheless, there's a lot that's instructive. Really, it's the biography of a very ordinary church. It had its ups and downs. It's the sort of church that just bumbled along in its life, but it existed for 200 years. So it's not without interest along the way. So if you'll excuse me, we'll get on with it. Now, please excuse me sitting. It's just that if I stand, I'm prone to fall over. And that would be a distraction to you. Now, as far as I'm aware, what you would call strict and particular Baptist churches are thin on the ground in the northeast of England. While it was still published, in fact, I believe it still is, the present edition of the Grace Directory lists only three in this part of the world, one in Darlington, one in Hartlepool, and the other in Hemlington. And all three places are well to the south of the area that we're going to look at in a few moments. Grace magazine's predecessor, The Christian's Pathway, included two other entries in its directory, one in Newcastle, the other in Sunderland. The one in Newcastle became defunct in the 1960s, and the one in Sunderland in the 1970s. Nevertheless, there are Baptist churches in the region which rank among the oldest in the country. They, or congregations descended from them, are now chiefly associated with the Baptist Union. But for most of their history, until relatively recently, they would have been at home in the constituency that I described just now. And it's the purpose of the paper that I'm giving today to focus on just one of them, a church which existed in the Northumberland town of Hexham between 1652 and 1789. My first heading, This Dark Corner. Northumberland is England's border county. Cross its northern rim and you're in Scotland. It takes its name from the River Humber. It originally meant the land north of the Humber. Now, at first sight, this might seem odd, since the width of two whole counties, County Durham and Yorkshire, lie between the broad estuary and the county which bears its name. It is, however, an echo of that early period in English history when Northumberland, or Northumbria, was properly speaking the name of a kingdom. And by the way, it went all the way up to Edinburgh at that time, anciently. I like, when I go to visit my son who lives there, to remind local people who live in Edinburgh that we Northumbrians wanted back. It's a different river, the River Tyne, whose name is inextricably linked with the present county, and follow it upstream from its mouth at Tynemouth and you pass through the once bustling heartland of the Industrial Revolution. The mines are closed now. The once shipyards and forges lie derelict and silent. And approximately 25 miles west of Newcastle, the river divides. Follow the North Tyne to its source, and it will take you into the Cheviot Hills. The South Tyne goes in a straight line, straight ahead. And that will take the wanderer high into the Pennines to its source on the slopes of the mighty Cross Fell. At the point where the two tributaries join, there is the town of Hexham. Close to Hadrian's Wall, or as local people call it, simply the Roman Wall, the mailed boot of the Roman legionary once walked its streets. The tonsured missionaries of Celtic Christianity and the turbulent days when England's northern frontier was a fluid, debatable land where the crosses of St. George and St. Andrew marked armies that were perpetually locked in conflict, and where peace simply marked the transition from official hostilities to the endemic border sport of cattle raiding and feuding. Now, nowadays it's an attractive place, dominated by the Abbey Church of St. Wilfrid and the place where local builders plundered the earlier work of Roman masons. It was to this town that a man named Thomas Tillam came in 1651. He arrived there at a time where there had been considerable turmoil in the region. Nearby Newcastle had been briefly occupied by the Scots in what was known as the Bishop's War of 1640. When the Civil War began in 1642, Newcastle had declared for the king. What would you expect of them? I speak as a son of Sunderland, a town which declared for Parliament. When Parliament negotiated an alliance with the Scots, the city once more fell into Scottish hands. The two northeastern counties of Northumberland and Durham were effectively under Scots control from 1644 to 47. So when Thomas Tilham came up to Hexham, Newcastle was garrisoned briefly by Commonwealth troops, and the whole region seems to have been largely bereft of evangelical religion. In 1650, the villagers of a place called Moggleswick — anybody ever been to Moggleswick? Good. A dozen miles southeast of Hexham, the villagers there had sent a petition to Parliament complaining that they and the people of 12 neighbouring parishes had no access at all to a preaching minister. Now, it's possible that Tilham came north in answer to that petition. A parliamentary commission had been set up to further the propagation of the gospel in the four northern counties. Let me just explain. That's not the northern counties as they are now, since the invention of things like Tyne and Wear and Cleveland. It's the old four northern counties: Northumberland, Cumberland, Westmorland, and Durham. I ought to add that, like a good son of County Durham, I regard Yorkshire as being in the south of England. Now, Baptist influence was growing in the Commonwealth, and Hexham was at that time an attractive location for a preaching ministry, because in 1628 a lectureship had been endowed upon the Abbey Church in Hexham by the Mercers Company of London, pursuant to the will and bequest of a Mr. Richard Fishburne. Now, lectureships were a feature of the early Puritan period. It was a reasonably common feature of life in that period for ministers who could not cope in the national church, because they'd be made to wear things like a surplice, to do things like make the sign of the cross at the baptism of infants and that sort of thing. So in order to help them not violate their consciences, they would be paid to be the parish lecturer, so that they'd not have to wear all the Anglican paraphernalia and go through various other Anglican bits and pieces, and they would simply be described as a lecturer, and they could function as a Protestant minister without having to go through all that stuff. And at any rate, Tilham, usually spelt T-I-A-A-M, or sometimes Tilham, T-I-L-H-A-M. Well, he took up the post of lecturer. His name can be found inscribed in the list of rectors of the Abbey Church of St. Wilfrid in Hexham. So if you ever go there, you'll see it inscribed with all the list of parish ministers. But it's believed that he held his meetings as a kind of Baptist Trojan horse in the south transept of the Abbey Church. And later, when conditions changed and the Commonwealth was over, the Baptist congregation moved to a village called Juniper, which is in the region of Hexhamshire, just to the south of the town of Hexham itself. Well, Tilham was to prove an extreme example of the type. This man flamed like a comet across the Northumbrian sky. Now, very little is known about his origins and what became of him after his brief time in the Northeast is equally obscure. He appears to have had some connections with Cheshire and originally came of Roman Catholic stock. By the time we come across him, he was a member of the Coleman Street Church in London. And this church, under the care of a man named Hansard Knollys, among others, sent him north as its messenger. And he soon gathered a church around himself. The first entry in the church book in Hexham reads like this: "In the name of the Lord Christ, I came to Hexham the 27th day of the 10th month." Now, by the way, the 10th month is December. You see the first syllable, D-E-C, from Decius in the Latin for the number 10. "And so wonderfully hath God appeared in this dark corner that upon the 21st day of the 5th month, 1652, after serious consideration and some gospel preparation, a living temple began of living stones, the Church of Christ in Hexham." Now, by the way, curiously, the church book is included with the church book of Fenstanton and Warboys. Three strange churches to add together in a single church book: Fenstanton, Warboys, and Hexham. The names of 16 people are appended as the first members of the church there, as having been baptized, and this is an interesting expression, and having given up themselves to the Lord and to each other. A 17th person, who was Tilham's wife, Jane, was received into membership by transfer from the church in Cheshire. It's believed, by the way, that the church in Cheshire was a very ancient church from a place called Hill Cliff, which is near Warrington. Over the next 2 years, encouraging progress took place. John Thirlwall, a prosperous farmer, was appointed deacon and given care of what was called the stock of the church. In other words, the church's bits and pieces. Well, baptisms were frequent. It seems that these were usually accompanied by what was called the fourth principle. Have a think. That was the laying on of hands. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 2. If you want to find out a scriptural reference for what that might have meant. So by the end of 1652, early in the Commonwealth, baptisms and transfers had brought the total church membership up to 36. Not bad going, really. Now, second heading, "By Schisms Rent Asunder." I'm quoting a hymn, of course. 1653 was to be an eventful year. On the positive side, the young church dispatched Tilham down to Cheshire, the place his wife came from, where his preaching was used to bring many additions to the church there. And upon his return to Northumberland, the work went on apace. The church book records that because of his preaching and that of a brother named Stephen Anderton, in several parts of the country, many precious souls fly as a cloud and as doves to their windows. And during the course of that year, further additions brought the membership to 47. In the meantime, Tillam had made a foray into North Yorkshire to a place called Stokesley, not far beyond Middlesbrough, really. His preaching was instrumental in persuading the local minister, William Kay, and 19 others to undergo believers' baptism, frequently called at that time disciples' baptism. A good use of the term, I think. Stokesley, incidentally, is 75 miles from Hexham. Now, just remind yourself that that was not a journey that would take about an hour and a half by car. On horseback, it would take a considerable amount of time by the standard of the roads in use at the time. Tillam described this affair as a work of wonder and calling for our high praises. Another incident of a similar kind took place soon after his return from Yorkshire. The River Derwent. Now, by the way, there are 13 rivers called Derwent in England. It's a translation originally from Old Welsh, from words meaning white water. Imagine when the first Anglo-Saxons got to Britain and asked the locals, "What do you call that thing?" pointing to a river. And the local ancient Brits, the ancestors of the Welsh, looking at it said, "These English are crazy. Of course it's white water. Dŵr Wen in Welsh." And so it's not surprising that you come across rivers called Derwent all over the place. But this particular Derwent flows into the Tyne at Bladen. And for much of its course, it forms the southern boundary of Northumberland with County Durham. And one of the villages in that valley is Muggleswick, that we mentioned a little earlier, about a dozen miles from Hexham. In May 1653, Tillam had arranged to baptise 8 new converts who lived thereabouts. He probably baptised them in the River Derwent. Now, the novelty of that occasion would be striking. It would be many centuries since the baptism of adult believers had taken place in that part of the country. Three Peter Baptist ministers took advantage of the occasion to try conclusions with Tillam, to have a public debate with him. In the event, Tillam defended his practice very ably, and six of the bystanders requested believers' baptism and were baptised the very next day. But while all of this was going on, events took a turn for the worse. Tillam's own pungent phrase records this. On the 4th of June 1653, a child of the devil came from Rome to ruin this church. Whatever was going on? Now, looking at the incident from a distance of more than 300 years, as we do, it contains what you might call a sizable element of farce. The child of the devil in question was a Scot. Please don't take me to infer that every Scot is a child of the devil. I didn't mean it that way at all. His name was Ramsay, and he was in fact a Roman Catholic. During a visit to the continent, Jesuits had persuaded him to act the part of a Jewish convert to Protestantism. And he'd even been circumcised in order to make his claim to be a Jew all the more credible. Now, for any adult who didn't have to undergo that procedure, that seems both unnecessarily painful and, frankly, more than a bit weird. It would seem that the Jesuits were hoping to use this man to infiltrate the Baptist churches that existed in England. Now, that in itself seems a bit odd, because Baptist churches in England in the 1650s were frankly a despised minority. So, well, why bother, you ask yourself? But anyway, it's interesting to note that these handful of Baptist churches did seem to be considered enough of a threat to make that worthwhile. So Ramsay sailed across the North Sea in a vessel called the Elizabeth, registered at Newcastle, and upon landing in that city, he made his way to Hexham, found the church, passed himself off as a convert, and called himself Joseph Ben Israel. Now, Tillam took him at face value, baptized him. Mercifully, before he could be received into church membership as a baptized believer, word reached Thomas Tillam from Newcastle claiming that Ramsay was a counterfeit. It seems that during his brief stay in Newcastle, four ministers in that city, not one of them a Baptist, had rushed into print with a pamphlet with this title: A False Jew, or a Wonderful Discovery of a Scot Baptized at London for a Christian, Circumcised at Rome to act as a Jew, Rebaptized at Hexham for a believer, but found out at Newcastle to be a cheat. Now, this meant that Tillam had to undergo the humiliation of bringing his injured friend, as he thought, to Newcastle to face his accusers, only to find that Ramsay couldn't maintain his deception under vigorous cross-questioning, and admitted that he was indeed a cheat. So in due course, Ramsay was sent to Cromwell as a popish agitator. It's hard to escape the conclusion that Tillam's opponents in Newcastle rather enjoyed leaving him with egg on his face. Their central charge in the pamphlet was that Tillam was naively ready to administer believers' baptism to anybody who was trying to pass themselves off as a true convert to Christianity. And this is how they put it. Who being taxed by us for letting in so hastily this counterfeit Jew, whom he before knew to have told so many plotted lies, and likewise asked by one of them present, if a man should come to him with the French pox on his nose, that means syphilis, by the way, and from committing adultery the night before, but profess the faith of the gospel and desire to be baptized by him, whether he would baptize him or no, he told us he would immediately baptize him. Do you see what's going on here? These ministers in Newcastle are effectively making this allegation. These Baptists are dreadfully irresponsible. They'll baptize anybody who claims to have an evangelical conversion. You can't trust them. They're credulous. Now, Tillam answered with a pamphlet of his own. Now, by the way, I've read both of these pamphlets. They're in the Newcastle City Library. So you can borrow them. Although they're both very delicate now because they're 300 years old. Tillam's pamphlet was called The Banners of Love Displayed Over the Church of Christ Walking in the Order of the Gospel at Hexham, or An Answer to a Narrative Stuffed with Untruths by Four Newcastle Gentlemen. Tillam's complaint was essentially that the Four Newcastle Gentlemen had shown an uncharitable spirit, and because of that were doing as much to unravel the work of the gospel as the counterfeit Jew himself had done. Now, in response, you see, to the charge that he himself, Thomas Tillam, was majoring on Baptist minors, as the Four Newcastle Gentlemen had alleged, this is what he said in response. Whereas the gentlemen present us to the world as owning such for living monuments of free grace, that do only but close with our opinion, it is a great untruth. We do well know that few or none desire communion with us, but such as are convinced of disciples' baptism only, and therefore it is the least matter we seek after. Our main business is to labour as far as the rule leads us, to find their faith firm. In other words, to check that they really are believers. Their repentance, right. A competent measure of self-knowledge and self-denial. Their conversation, holy, since the time they were enlightened. And by these fruits, we judge them that desire fellowship with us to have passed through the pangs of new birth, and subjects fit for baptism. And hereupon we show them all the forms and ordinances of the temple, the outgoings and incomings, and so open the arms of our dearest affection to them. But more trouble was to arise from the same quarter. That is the four Newcastle gentlemen. Even before the church in Hexham was established, a Baptist cause had been planted in Newcastle in 1650. The pastor of that church was a man named Gower. There seems to have been a measure of antipathy between that man and Thomas Tillam. In part, this stemmed from a difference of opinion, can you believe it, about ministerial remuneration. Gower seems to have been an army officer, that's in the parliamentary army, so he was financially independent. He didn't make any charge to the church in Newcastle, whereas Thomas Tillam wasn't able to do that. He was dependent on remuneration from the Mercer's company that gave him his lectureship. But Gower had given credence to a number of accusations that were circulating about Thomas Tillam. Now, these accusations seem scarcely credible 300 years down the road, but here they are. These are the things that Gower was circulating about his colleague. Number one, that he'd baptised 12 persons at Norwood Castle. That's probably Norworth, which is near the border between Northumberland and Cumberland. And had proclaimed that they were his apostles and he was their God. Now that kind of thing smacks more of that diseased character, James Taylor, that was operating in the United States about two decades ago. Second accusation, that he'd accepted various sums from baptismal candidates. And the sums that are cited, 12 shillings, 14 shillings, and 20 shillings. Are any of you old enough to remember the old currency? One or two of you are. Well, 20 shillings is a quid. I know we went decimal when I was still a student, and nowadays 100 pence is a pound, but it used to be 240 pence when I were a lad, and that amounted to 20 shillings. imagine somebody comes to their pastor and says, I feel that it's right for me to be baptized. The Lord has made this plain to me. Can we have a talk about it? And the pastor says, well, it'll cost you. Now, allowing for inflation since the middle years of the 17th century, what do you suppose a pound then would cost in today's values? Third accusation, that Mr. Tillam had been found drunk on the road. Probably the equivalent of the A690 going between Hexham and Newcastle. Fourth accusation, that he'd robbed a man near Corbridge. You know, Corbridge is about 6 miles out of Hexham on the way to Newcastle. Fifth accusation, this is the gift that keeps on giving, isn't it? That some whom he'd baptised presently went mad, had the palsy, were blind, have been drowned, have hanged themselves, and many such like untruths. I don't know what you make of all that. Does it say more about Mr. Gower than it does about Mr. Tillam? But things reached their lowest ebb when Gower began correspondence with the church at Coleman Street in London, which had sent Thomas Tillam north in the hope of persuading them to disown Tillam, and they reluctantly felt that they had to, and Tillam eventually ended up resigning from the church at Hexham. And it's all the more poignant as the Hexham church had previously written to Coleman Street asking them to grant him independence from Coleman Street so that he could become minister at Hexham. And the repercussions were disastrous. Two of the members, Stephen Anderton, Thomas Ogle, were delivered to Satan for siding with the church at Coleman Street over the matter of the laying on of hands, the fourth principle. The church also withdrew from two other members, John Ward and John Redshaw, on the grounds that they fitted the descriptions in Romans 1:31 and 2 Timothy 3:3. That is to say that they were without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection, implacable and unmerciful, and more besides if I read all the scriptures that are cited. Now, I've no doubt that Tillam was to some extent a contributor. When there's church trouble, all the fault is rarely on one side. But no doubt he was a contributor and to some extent was a gullible and tempestuous man. But looking back, his achievement was remarkable. Had it not been for seeds of doubt, though, sown by Thomas Gower, which germinated both in London and in Northumberland, the unhappy schism might have been avoided. Tillam left the north. His movements after that are uncertain. He seems to have spent periods of time in Germany, allegedly there to await the second coming. He went to London and was involved in Rotterdam. By the time he was there, the monarchy had been restored, and because he had associates with regicides, people who had been involved in the execution of the late King Charles I, it seems he was being hunted down. But that's the last we hear of him. So that brings me to our next section, the healing of hurts. The rift in the church was very keenly felt. In June of 1656, a meeting was held at Eddy's Bridge, which is in the Derwent Valley, but no agreement had been reached. But a happy outcome was to ensue just a month later. A crucial role in the reconciliation of the two groups was played by the Newcastle Church. It seems that Mr. Gower had moved on and been replaced by a new pastor at Newcastle, a Mr. Turner, where the two chief protagonists, Tillam and Gower, both now out of the way. Much of the heat was now out of the situation. and in the event, messengers from the Newcastle Church met separately with representatives of the factions, now from the Tyne Valley and also from the Derwent Valley. The church book records a joint meeting was held at Brother Joblin's, and each party declaring the sense of their miscarriage to the other. We were by the messengers declared to be one body in the Lord. So although fraternal relations had been restored, the congregation on the Tyne met chiefly at this stage at Raw House in Audley, which was the home of a man named Richard Ord, and at Dotland Park. Now, these places are to be found in the same way, and the Derwentside grouping also met at various places at this time, including a place called Foxholes and the home of that brother John Ward. And it's pleasing to see that Stephen Anderton, who'd become a casualty of the situation, was restored to fellowship in 1660. Now, the restoration of the monarchy brought problems. It brought problems for Baptist congregations everywhere. But the Baptist churches in the north, along with their sister churches throughout the country, found themselves in a precarious position. A series of laws had been passed, which were known as the Clarendon Code. They're given that name because the man who was effectively Prime Minister, although the term wasn't used yet, was a man called Edward Hyde, and he became known as the Earl of Clarendon. And a series of laws were passed with a view to making life as difficult as possible for nonconformists of different kinds. And these, of course, included Baptists. One of them was called the 5 Mile Act, which is that ministers were not allowed to preach within 5 miles of the site of their previous congregations. And there were other laws that formed part of this Clarendon Code, but that was one of the worst. Now, there was also the Conventicle Act of 1664, which made it illegal for congregations which didn't worship according to the Book of Common Prayer to assemble anywhere legally. And that held to be the case for well over 100 years. Travellers heading from Newcastle to Carlisle found that the Derwent Valley was in a tributary of the Tyne, which was going nowhere. So it was easy to worship in the Derwent Valley, but Hexham was much more problematic. So the Hexham congregation relocated into this village called Juniper. You can visit it. The house where they used to worship is still there. It's called the Dye House in the village of Juniper. So go and look for it if ever you're travelling that way. But it's about 6 miles south of Hexham proper. So the church on the Derwent was protected by obscurity. But the Hexhamshire congregation was close to a busy route, and the Abbey Church with its long history, going back really to the 6th century. Both churches were to experience severe trials in the period following the Restoration. certain prominent members of the Derwent congregation were implicated in a tragic comic affair known as the Muggleswick Plot. This was a minor sideshow of a more serious attempt to overthrow the government, the new monarchy, with Charles II at its head. A plot was hatched in Harrogate, attempting to coordinate an armed rising at Farnley Wood near Leeds in October 1663. Contingents were going to be recruited from near Durham, near Westmorland as well, and in Yorkshire. Now, the whole affair was a farce. No more than 200 men gathered at Farnley, and having thrown up a few earthworks, they dispersed the very next day. Having crossed the border into Durham, they soon thought better of the whole idea and just went home. Nevertheless, the authorities were sufficiently alarmed to mount a witch hunt for the conspirators, and 26 of the rebels were actually executed. But at one stage, it seemed as though some of the Baptists from the Derwent Valley might be among them, and everything hinged on the testimony of one man, John Elrington, who came, you'll know the place, some of you, from Blanchland. This man, himself a member of the church, made a statement before four magistrates implicating some of the prominent men of the church, including Elder John Ward. Elrington alleged that seditious meetings had taken place at Muggleswick. The plotters aimed, he said, to rise in rebellion against the government, to destroy the present parliament, which made a law against liberty of conscience, to break all organs in pieces. That, by the way, tells its own story about contemporary attitudes to the use of instrumental music in worship. To destroy the common prayer books, to pull down all churches, to further kill the gentry that should either oppose them or not join with them in their design, that they intended first to fall upon Durham, to seize any magazine that might be there. Magazine, that just means any collection of weapons or ammunition, or money in any treasurer's hands, and to plunder the town. Now, that would have been an ambitious project for a sizable military force, let alone a handful of Anabaptist farmers from the Durham Dales. But it seems that lack of evidence meant that no convictions could be secured against this poor chap who ended up giving his evidence. And you wonder whether John Elrington was not attempting to settle some kind of private score or ingratiate himself with the new order. But Surtees, who was the author of the county history of Durham, dismisses the whole story as a laughable fabrication. He puts it this way: the two troops of Anabaptist horse, the men who forded the Derwent with glittering swords, are reduced to Joseph Hopper, who took a 5 weeks' jaunt to Ireland and had reasons for not telling his wife. Well, we need to move on. From this time, it becomes difficult to separate events and participants, but we do know that several Anabaptists were examined by the Bishop of Durham at Auckland Castle in March 1663, but the want of any real evidence against them leaves us in no doubt and in no position to assess how far, if at all, the Baptists of the Derwent Valley were involved in this desperate venture. And in the meantime, the Hexham Church had fallen on rather thin times. After this, the church had begun to decline their duties, break off their meetings, and forget their rock, whereupon miserable effects ensued to be their portion, so that many of them returned to folly. In this state they continued for many years. But in due course the church in the Derwent Valley sought them out, asked for a meeting with them, and things little by little began to improve again. And the entreaties of the group in Derwent, assisted again by Mr. Turner of Newcastle, had the desired effect. There are three excommunications noted for the year 1678, one for refusing to hear or come to the church, a second for joining with the Quakers. Just imagine that. If you found that someone in your church has started going to Quaker meetings, would you consider that sufficient reason to close their membership? But the Quakers in the late 17th century were considered a heretical movement. Their views on the Holy Spirit were considered outright heresy, because it was considered that God spoke directly through the speech of the Holy Spirit, and that was equivalent to Holy Scripture. And the third person was excommunicated for owning herself to be a papist. In other words, I'm not really a Baptist, I'm a Catholic. Well, the churches of the late 17th century evidently witnessed the same inconsistency on the part of some members that can still be observed three centuries on. In 1678, one Michael Aidan, under suspicion for excessive drinking, was withdrawn again, according to 2 Thessalonians 3. Upon his repentance, was again joyfully received. But in 1682, that's 4 years later, the same man, having succumbed once more to excessive drinking, was excommunicated. The fifth person to have been baptized by Thomas Tillam, this very man, seems to have given the church considerable heartache over the years with what Douglas, the historian of the Northern Churches, quaintly terms his tendency to occasional but excessive inebriation. Next heading, introduce you to another character. The Stormy Petrel of the Northern Association. That's a group of churches that existed at the time. And it included churches in what were then Westmorland and Cumberland and County Durham. By the last decade of the 17th century, the church on the Derwent was meeting in three centres. One church in three different places. It was considered perfectly consistent at that time to have that kind of identity. By the way, I found this a great help, my studies in this area, when, as the pastor of a church in Lancaster, we began to plant a church in Ulverston. And we felt for a number of years that we could have a church in two sites. Until that church had grown sufficiently to become independent of us and could become a church in its own right. Well, services continued at Muggleswick and at Hindley in the Derwent Valley, and a new sphere of endeavour had opened up further south in the valley of the Weir. An Irishman named Henry Blackett had taken up residence at Bitchburn in Weardale. He'd originally lived in Belfast, and as a baby he'd been rescued by his nurse when he'd heard of a Roman Catholic plot to murder Protestants. Now, in the course of time, he'd become an elder of the church, along with Ward, and commenced meetings at his home. The church on Derwent side, and now Weir side, always seems to have been more vigorous than its northern neighbour in Hexhamshire. In 1678, its elders, Ward and Blenkinsop, were instrumental in planting yet another Baptist church at Torver. Now, Torver is actually in the Furness district, then part of Lancashire. Lancashire beyond the sands, in other words, Lancashire north of Morecambe Bay, which is now part of the county of Cumbria, after all those boundary changes in 1974. The congregation which is descended from the one planted at Torver now has its building at Hawkshead Hill. Now we see John Ward assisting at the formation of the church at Bridlington on the Yorkshire coast in 1698. You see how active these people are and how willing to move about the whole north of England. Now, as for the church at Hexhamshire, where we began the story, we know very little of developments there after the death of Richard Ord in 1696. And it seems likely that for the next half century, they were supplied with ministry from the church in Newcastle. One of its locations, Hindley, is reasonably close still to Hexham. And some of its members may have attended services there. The closing chapter of the story of the Hexham church belongs to a man named David Fernie. He was a Scot. He was called the Stormy Petrel of the Northern Association. And that brings us right up to the 1740s. The intervening decades had seen some consolidation of the work on the Derwent. The changed climate after the Glorious Revolution of 1698 1688, had made it possible for nonconformists to leave their old clandestine existence, half in hiding, behind, and two meeting houses had been built. The group which had been meeting at Bitchburn in the Weir Valley were the first to erect a chapel, and that was at Hamsterley in 1715. Our chapel still stands. It's something of a cameo. It's a straightforward preaching house with an appealing, rugged simplicity. The section which met on the Derwent followed suit, erecting a chapel at Cold Rowley in 1717. The two sections still thought of themselves at this time as two sites of a single church. Links with the Hexhamshire church remained cordial, and by now its main centre of activity was still the Juniper Dye House. The Dye House was the home of a man named William Angus, and the Angus family were very important in Baptist life at this stage. It's telling that a young man a century later, named Charles Spurgeon, sought an interview in his early life as a Baptist preacher with a member of the Angus family. In 1745, a significant ministry began when Isaac Garner accepted a call to the ministry of the church meeting at Hamsterley and also at Cold Rowley. He'd first visited Hamsterley at the age of 24 in 1741. And it seems likely that this regional association of Baptist churches had its first meeting in 1690. Well, I'm anxious not to keep you much longer. And that brings us to David Fernie. He's an interesting man. He's indicative of a tendency that you can detect at that stage in Baptist life in the late 17th and early 18th century, which was high Calvinism, or as it's sometimes called, hyper-Calvinism. And when he passed from the scene, it's then that the Baptist Church in Hexham really passed from the scene, because the census of 1801 indicates that it had ceased to be. There's no more indication of it having a meeting place or there being any people attached to it. Although there's still a Baptist Union Church at Stocksbridge, which is just along the Tyne Valley from Corbridge, and it's likely that that is probably where the remaining members of the church in Hexham finished up. And that's still there. I've spotted it. I don't know much about its life or what shade of evangelical opinion it follows now. So there we are. A small church which flourished briefly in the late 17th century and which for a time, as I can best put it, probably bumbled along, and which has descendants in various parts of the northeast. I mean, there's still a small church, for instance, in the Wear Valley at Walsingham, as well as at, I believe the church at Hamsterley still continues in some fashion. Yes, it does. There are those of you who would know better than I do what the state of things there still is. I'm going to stop, though, because you've been extremely patient and I've probably tried your patience rather too long.